When I was a kid, I wanted to get to heaven so bad. You see, there was a time when I went to a lot of masses for various relatives who had died, and they were always held in these grand cathedrals with these cloud-painted ceilings, and there was winged cherubs, and there were these larger-than-life angels, and the priest would talk about heaven as a reward for being a good person and as a place where you could get anything you wanted. So I remember driving home from my parents from one of those funerals and was babbling on in the back seat about how what I was going to do when I finally got to heaven and how I wished I could get there right now so I could eat all the ice cream and drink all the chocolate milk that I wanted. Well, my dad, who had rejected his Catholic roots for science, was a little cranky with my incessant talking about heaven. And finally, I remember him saying, "Kathleen, there is no heaven. There is no place you go when you die. It's a story that's made up to make you feel better about dying." This was to an 8-year-old. Wow. Well, that shut me up pretty quick. And I remember going to my mom and asking her about what Dad had said, and my mother, who was a little more nuanced in her theology than my dad, said, "You know, your dad was raised with a lot of stories that he doesn't believe anymore. So we don't really know if there is a heaven or a hell for that matter, but what matters more is what we do here, today, and tomorrow, and the rest of your life." And that's what I try to think about. Well, that made sense to me back then, and I felt a kind of relief that I didn't have to believe in something that didn't quite make sense. And you know, at our new member gatherings, we find a number of people who, even though they may have loved the faith that they grew up with, just can't buy some part of the theology. And the insistence on a belief in a heaven or a hell is just one of the many reasons why they, maybe you, decided to check out something else. I'll never forget a story told to me by a woman who was at a new member gathering, and after many years of searching, she was delighted to finally find a religious and spiritual home in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. And when she told her family that she was going to church, she said that instead of being happy for her that she got religion, they were worried and sad. "Worried and sad?" I said. "I thought they'd be happy that you were attending a church at all." And she said, "No." She said, "They're sad for me because I won't be able to join them in heaven. They said they would pray for me and hope that one day we could be together for eternity in heaven." Well, now, I don't know about you, but being together with anybody for eternity actually sounds like hell. Really. Honestly. And Harpeth Rising's song, Proof, it doesn't mention heaven at all, but there were two lines that led me to view it with my universalist lens. It says, "Let me tell you what she told me, though it might be hard to hear. I would rather hurt your feelings than watch you live in fear. There's no reward for good behavior, and there's no such thing as fair. You can build the highest tower, but there's no answer there." Oof. Well, our earliest Universalist ancestor had a different take on heaven, one that was steeped in the 18th and 19th century theology of their time. And they would argue, actually, that Harpeth Rising's line, "There's no reward for good behavior," they would argue against that because they believed actually in heavenly reward, but not heavenly punishment. And I like that. Our Universalist ancestors probably would have supported the concept of heaven made famous by Saint Brigitte of Kildare. She was actually a 6th century Irish nun who wrote this vision of heaven. She said, "I should like a great lake of beer for the King of Kings. I should like the angels of heaven to be drinking it through time eternal." That was one vision of heaven that would be like a giant Oktoberfest that lasted on through eternity. Some of our Universalist ancestors would have liked that. One of the hallmarks of Unitarian Universalism is that we view religious beliefs through the lens of what I call rational mysticism. We are the doubting Thomases of religion, in that we place our faith more in what we know or in what we experience than in trusting some abstract concept or florid promises that have been handed to us. we're also mystics in that we can appreciate these great concepts without insisting that they be literally true. Now, some of us here may indeed believe in a literal heaven, but our understanding of what heaven is will vary widely from person to person. And some of us here may flatly deny the existence of heaven, demanding proof of its existence, which, of course, is impossible. But I tend to agree with the Unitarian Universalist Forrest Church, who, in his book Love and Death, wrote this. He said, quote, "No one knows whether heaven actually exists. All we can say with any confidence about the afterlife is that it cannot be any stranger or more unexpected than life before death. The least prepared pilgrim could be not be any more startled by heaven the moment following death than an embryo would be astonished by life on earth the moment following birth. Nonetheless, we can learn something about the appropriateness of our earthly desires from the images we create of heaven. Many of them are really quite silly, an eternity of harps and halos and hymnals, the heavenly hosts fluffed up by the clouds singing hosannas forever. Whatever happens after we die, I hope it isn't this." So defined, heaven then might be best described as punishment for good behavior. So what do we really know? I can only say what I know, and that is I have been in heaven more times than I can count. Not the angel-y hosanna heaven, but the real heaven on earth heaven. The one where I am walking hand in hand with my beloved, completely absorbed in the drama of a Wisconsin sunset, or feeling the sweat on my own skin after a perfect 5-mile run, or getting the chance to create worship and justice and caring and music all at the same time. This is heaven to me. I can't imagine anything more heavenly than that. And the fact that I'm living it now, it's all the proof I will ever need. So we're going to move from heaven now to consider another realm of existence. So hear now the song by Harpeth Rising entitled Providence. My husband Wayne and I are rarely interested in new comedy shows that are rolled out every fall, but one of those new shows, The Good Place, caught our attention. The premise was intriguing. Eleanor, who's played by Kristen Bell, dies and is sent to heaven called The Good Place. But wait, there's been a mistake. We get flashbacks of her life, and she turns out to be actually a pretty self-centered, deceptive, manipulative person. Michael, who is played by Ted Danson, is the angel responsible for bringing her to the good place and doesn't know this about her. So Eleanor's job is to learn to be a good person so she can continue to stay in the good place instead of being sent to the bad place, where you will occasionally hear agonizing screams and moans and groans when the bad place is mentioned. So, as is true with many depictions of heaven and hell, it can get pretty cheesy, if I can say that, pretty quickly. And by that I mean it gets theologically quite simple. Good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell. And although today in our 21st century, even the most conservative religious traditions have softened their position on hell a little bit, it was our universalist ancestors who insisted that hell did not need to exist. So the universalist part of this faith tradition believes in universal salvation, which means that a loving God embraces all, would not condemn anyone to eternal hellfire and damnation. So some early universalists believed in the existence of an afterlife as a place of moral correction. You could say that's another perspective. Hell is a kind of anteroom to heaven, but the person wouldn't be put there indefinitely. And others, like the 19th century Reverend Hosea Ballou, denied the existence of hell altogether. So for him, it was both irrational and unnecessary. It was irrational because it didn't make sense to him. A loving God would condemn people to everlasting torment, and that was cruel, and that God was not cruel. And it was unnecessary because Ballou believed that human beings indeed had both the capacity for great cruelty and great kindness, but that it was his hope that being in a relationship with God would be a motivation for our goodness. So one of the stories that's told about Baloo is that one afternoon he was riding his horse through the hills of New Hampshire alongside a Baptist preacher, and they argued about theology as they traveled. And at one point, the Baptist looked over and said, "Brother Baloo, if I were a universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." And Jose Baloo looked over at him and said, "If you were a universalist, the idea would not have occurred to you." I love that. I love that quote because it's Baloo banking on his friend's essential goodness to do no harm. But there's something that Baloo didn't fully comprehend, and that is that the concept of hell is not based, of course, on reason, but on our very irrational emotions that we need for justice. Hell was created as a way of keeping people in line. But there is a more difficult reason why hell was invented, and that is because that justice sometimes does not happen here on earth. So we want justice to happen sometime, somewhere. There are some crimes that go unpunished, and there are some people whose crimes are so heinous that a life in prison does not seem punitive enough. Some people seem to be so bad that it would appear the only way to balance the scales of justice is to have them in hell. That's why this is such a challenging faith. You know, maybe there are times when we'd like to condemn someone and say that their soul is irredeemable, but our belief in the human capacity to evolve from hate to love prohibits that. If you are here for the first time, I hope that this service will inspire you to come back and be amazed that in a world where religion seems sometimes trivial at best or downright dangerous at worst, there is a faith that is determined to try to make heaven on this earth and to save all souls from a hell of theirs or our society's making. So we're going to conclude with a famous hymn, and it's Amazing Grace. Many of you probably know the story behind it. It's been a bit romanticized. The bones of it are true. John Newton was a slave owner. He had an epiphany while taking a boatload of slaves across the Atlantic. What we don't often hear is it took him 34 years after this epiphany to finally renounce completely the slaving profession. But the words to Amazing Grace have transcended the story.